From Given, this is Purposing, the podcast that lifts the lid on how to run a truly purpose-driven business. I'm Becky Willen, and with the help of leaders at some of the world's most recognized brands, I'll be demystifying this often misunderstood topic into clear, actionable advice you can use in your own business. To mark the first episode of 2026, we're doing things a bit differently. Today, I'm joined by Matt Bell, our new CEO at Anthesis, for a more forward-looking, strategic conversation about what lies ahead. With a doctorate in biotechnology and genetic engineering, Matt has spent decades transforming environmental science into practical strategies that help drive real-world change. So what do sustainability leaders need to be preparing for in 2026? In this conversation, you'll hear what will shape the sustainability agenda in 2026 and where leaders should focus their attention, how the role of the Chief Sustainability Officer is evolving as sustainability moves from ambition to action, and what role AI can play in sustainability and the capabilities that will separate the leaders from the laggards. But before all that, let's explore the experiences that shaped Matt's approach to leadership and his drive to create change that truly matters.
So, like most people, I didn't get into sustainability because it didn't exist a few decades ago. And I started out my career as a scientist, so a deep love for nature, a huge passion for trying to understand the world.
But over time, Matt began to feel the limits of science alone. And as climate science sharpened, so did the urgency, pushing him from research into government and then into advisory work with business.
But the science was moving towards water and climate, and I started to research as much as possible, as you do as a scientist. And I became pretty perturbed by what it was telling me. And so I made a move across into policy, ended up leading the Programme Office for Climate and Energy for UK government.
But there were two moments later in his career that cemented what this work meant and why it mattered. The first came in a boardroom, listening to a celebrated business leader describe success without acknowledging its human cost.
And then he went on to tell a story about how he had visited a part of Eastern Europe where they dyed their clothing. And he had met with the manager of the factory, and it was a small town where they literally just did that. And he said a lot of the people were losing their hair and the lifespan was less. But he said, you can't apply a Western mindset, Matt. You've got to think about these things. We're giving them employment in a place they otherwise wouldn't have it.
What stayed with Matt wasn't just what he said, but what wasn't challenged.
And of course, now everybody would reel in horror. But in the room at the time, no one really did. No one batted an eyelid. And I thought, if people like this guy are leading organizations globally and they're bringing this mindset, I have to do much more.
The second moment was far closer and far more personal.
So I was doing some work from an environmental perspective, working down a mine. These very large electric trucks are not supposed to travel in the shafts when you're in there. And this 6.5-ton truck came around the corner and it dove into the wall about half a meter from us and nearly killed us.
When Matt raised the incident, it was made very clear that productivity mattered more to them than safety.
And he was furious with us. Their mine was going to be out of action for, 18 hours. He basically kicked me off the site. And I let it go, Becky. And it is the one thing that I will regret for the rest of my life, because 2 weeks later, six men died at that mine. The Gulf collapsed.
And to this day, these experiences remind him just how important this work is.
You need to know that the actions that we take in sustainability, they are actually life and death. And so these two things for me have kind of kept me focused on what's most important. And it's why I do what I do.
So Matt, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Becky. It's great to be here.
So this episode is a little bit different, more big picture, future focused than the usual deep dives. But I want to start with a bit of scene setting. So as you look ahead to 2026, what do you think is fundamentally different about the sustainability agenda compared to, say, 2 or 3 years ago?
It's interesting, isn't it, when we think about what's coming in the year ahead. And I've kind of done this every year, Becky, you know, this sort of crystal ball gazing in January to think through what the new year holds. The truth is, we never know what happens in the new year. I don't think any of us would have predicted what happened in 2025 with, you know, segmented backlash to the sentiment around improving our environment and protecting people. But it does feel different this year somehow as we head into 26. And not least of which, I think, because a lot of the disruption that we saw in the past few years has resolved itself one way or the other, whether that's to, you know, lead to less regulation than many of us in sustainability would like to see, or, you know, a quietening of a narrative around what people are doing on sustainability despite action occurring. But nonetheless, I feel a lot more hope actually coming into this year. And if we think about it in terms of the sustainability professional, I feel like it's the year to get stuff done and actually, you know, turn back on the accelerator.
So a lot of people who have worked in sustainability for as long as you have, you know, more than 20 years, will have seen cycles of rising and declining ambition, engagement, investment before. You said that you feel kind of hopeful and optimistic. What makes you feel that? And is there anything sort of different this time around?
I guess there's a couple of reasons for optimism. The first is we have to be. As sustainability professionals, I think we have to be optimistic. The stakes are so high. And to my mind, that's what's different, right? I mean, when we were thinking about this 20 years ago, if we focus in on what most people think of when they think of sustainability nowadays, which is climate change, we knew so much. We had agreements back from 1990. You know, we had agreements that were setting us on a trajectory. And ultimately, come 2015, 10 years ago, we had an international agreement on how we should halve and then completely reduce greenhouse gas emissions at a global scale. The truth is, we haven't done it. We haven't done it fast enough. So I think what we've seen over this period of time is incrementalism in a world that's running out of time. So yes, I'm optimistic because of so many reasons and we can get into them, but I'm also more dogmatic because we absolutely need to do things in a shorter time frame than we've ever had before.
Yeah. You know, I guess if this is the age of really getting things done and we've got a, you know, as you say, kind of limited amount of time in which to do them, then I think one of the things that is shifting is just how choiceful sustainability leaders and their exec teams need to be about what the priorities are. I guess one of the things that I wanted to ask you was, are there particular types of activities or commitments that actually should be deprioritized versus ones that have really become non-negotiable?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I think you and I, Becky, have spent most of our lives championing all of the causes and championing all of the initiatives that have been developed for, you know, for companies and individuals to address the existential threats we face. But I actually think you're right. I think part of the challenge we've had is that we've either, as sustainability professionals, been co-opted into a wider narrative that's been unhelpful for us. You know, let's take, for example, gender politics and the woke agenda as it's seen from a US perspective. An awful lot of those narratives align with philosophies that people in sustainability have: equity, justice, people being treated equally. But at the same time, I don't think those issues, particularly around, you know, gender identity and politics, were the hot points for us around the issues that we needed to address first and most urgently. And I think detractors have used that to co-opt us so that all of our initiatives, all of our focus, has been deprioritized as being either, you know, wonky politics or naive sentiment. And the truth is that all of it instead is actually just anchored in the science and slightly more forward-looking than most organizations are. So I actually think one of the things I would suggest that most organizations, or at least individuals in sustainability inside organizations, should be doing is deprioritizing the grandiose and focusing on the real. If we think back to Glasgow, you know, our COP a few years ago, where so many of the financial services banking sector leaders CEOs stood up and all made very grand commitments to ensure that their debt portfolios would align to a net zero 1.5 degree aligned trajectory. I was so incredibly proud and happy.
Mm-hmm.
It's what we'd been working for such a long time. The challenge was that such a large goal, the moment it becomes challenging, gets cast off and forgotten. And instead, if we'd have broken that down into modular elements that were not just achievable, but they were going to be practical, resilient, and provide business benefits, at least if you can measure them in the midterm, we might have seen far more action. So maybe we need to get rid of the grandiose and attach ourselves to the practical.
Yeah. And I guess that really drives quite a big shift in what leadership now looks like in sustainability. So, you know, how would you describe courageous leadership right now?
It's funny, a year or so, maybe a couple of years ago now, I ended up, you know, when we were all first playing with our really comprehensive large language model AI systems, I started playing back and forth with this concept of how do we avoid a polycrisis whilst at the same time actually achieving action? Because you and I, Becky, we've been working with companies for a really long period of time. We've got them to do some incredible things. We've helped them achieve some incredible things, but the collective merits of all of those haven't supported what we need to at a global scale. And my AI collaborator came back and said that we should be acceptable radicals. And I really love it, actually, as a concept, because when you break that down, you cannot remove yourself with what we know from being seen as radical. What we are saying is our current capital structures are inadequate to be able to operate within planetary limits. And if that's the case, then everything that we are saying seems or is deemed radical to those who are seeking to try and maintain the norm. What we're saying is we know that that will collapse, and we're already starting to see, of course, collapses. But the first part of that, the acceptable part, was a real light bulb moment for me. Unless we are capable of being able to tell the story, and I know you are particularly good at this, right? Tell the story as to why the science or the evidence is important and how it relates to not just the environmental or social outcome, but the economic consequence for any organization that you're working with, then we become champions of a cause with no ability to create change.
Well, and we won't be in the room when the decisions get made.
Yeah, I mean, that's right.
So I want to touch on a few different dimensions of what might shape the year ahead. And let's start with the impact of regulation. And obviously, you know, in the recent past, this has been such an important driver of a lot of corporate activity related to sustainability. But it's also been a hugely, let's say, dynamic landscape. So how do you think sustainability leaders should see regulation? You know, is it about raising the floor? Is it about raising the ceiling? Or has it become a real distraction?
I mean, I hate to admit it, but regulation has probably been largely responsible for more action on sustainability than any other driver. You know, with some few exceptions from a voluntary perspective where we've seen real leadership at a corporate level. I would say, though, that it is probably raising the floor. There's nothing really in a regulatory framework that caps ambition or stops you from doing more and going beyond. What we know when we see regulatory change is that the bar raises.
Yeah.
So that floor comes up, and then the new standards get set around what the art of the possible is, and people ultimately then try and head towards the new bar that gets raised once again. And I'm hopeful for that.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that happens within some organizations, at least, is as the floor gets raised, the conversation starts about how much further we want to go as an organization. So whilst I agree, I think it's not true to say that regulation directly raises the ceiling. I think it can indirectly lead to conversations about ambition that are really helpful within organizations. Having said that, I think a lot of clients admit, privately at least, to feeling quite overwhelmed by regulation, not just, you know, the volume of it, but also the changing nature of it. So what advice would you give CSOs who feel that their role is becoming, you know, perhaps overly compliance driven?
I know you've got to be careful what you wish for, right? I mean, I think that's really true in our space. It's fair to say, I think a lot of chief sustainability officers and sustainability functions have now had to transition and spend a lot more of their time undertaking compliance activities. They've had to capture data that they never had to capture before. They needed to apply a rigor to their financial and non-financial metric management, you know, akin to a financial part of the business, like the finance office, and that we've never had to do that before. I'd probably make two recommendations. The first is, what is your specific role versus what is the role that others across the organization should take on? I don't believe that any of the changes, regulatory or voluntary, on sustainability have been driven to increase the scope and activity of the sustainability office itself alone. It's about changing an organization writ large. To do that, you know, that really does need a collaborative spirit. And in some cases, a collaboration that hasn't really had to happen a great deal before. I'm forever catching up with CFOs and CSOs together now. I mean, you know, what an unlikely set of bedfellows, right? But it turns out, incredibly powerful couple, because they working collectively can think through how capital should be applied for the longer term as opposed to, you know, for the short term. So that's been really powerful. The same with supply chain and chief procurement officers' roles as it relates to all of the issues that sustainability functions have been managing, you know, the risk officers and their risk functions, internal audit. These really should be kind of a pervasive expansion of those compliance-driven activities. And this is then the second piece of my advice, because it frees up strategy. And I really worry that there is no part of an organization that thinks about that company out beyond 5 years, and I'm being kind, other than the sustainability function. Like, who else does that? You know, again, most strategy functions, if they have them within an organization, you know, tend to think 3 to 5 years, and often using the same paradigms, the same business paradigms we've had since 1980s business school methodology.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So who's going to do that thinking? And you get to do less of that the more you are bogged down by work that should be and can be done by others in the organization, or increasingly outsourced, actually, when it comes to large compliance, or coming back to our old friend AI, even utilizing new technologies.
Yeah. And we will come back to that topic in this conversation. And I think we are seeing the role of the chief sustainability officer change and evolve. And I guess you work with and talk to lots of them. So what do you think the most effective CSOs do differently from their peers? What are the experiences, capabilities that are becoming even more important today?
Understanding the business that they operate in and the geopolitical context is probably the short answer. And I don't think I would have said that. I mean, I don't think, Becky, if we thought about the sort of organizations that you and I work with over the last few years, we would have said, you know, what's most important is really understanding your current business context. But it actually is, because it's not about being right. It's about getting the right outcomes. And we often find that sustainability leaders, whether that's inside companies or in NGOs or in government, we're often right. And that sounds a bit big-headed to say, but what I'm saying is we've often looked at the evidence, we've seen the forecasts of where we're going, we've seen the consequences of current activities, and we know that there needs to be a change. But not understanding what the drivers are, what the barriers are, who the people inside your organization that want to work with you and create a change agenda, if you don't get those things right, nothing happens. So honestly, it's the soft skills as well as the kind of hard knowledge around the organizational context that's becoming more important.
Yeah, fully agree with you there. And I guess if we get super practical for a moment, where should CSOs really focus their time and attention this year? And I guess maybe even more importantly, what should they stop doing?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think coming back to something we've talked about earlier, I think they need to stop doing things that others can do. And they should start doing things that only they can do. They should continue to be the alternative voice in the room where they know that that alternative voice is necessary for the long-term sustainability of the organization. And I think thinking about things in that way becomes important. We tend to think about sustainability, of course, as much more existential. It's not just our company. We think about that in the context of the operating environment that we're in. And then, you know, obviously the environment that we sit in and the society that surrounds us. Most companies don't think that way. And so the practical steps are to, I would say, move away from things that you don't need to do or find ways of doing them more efficiently. Focus in on the areas where you believe you could have greatest change and find those unlikely bedfellows who become, you know, your internal collaborators, and find the things that really will help them in their role. Is it around risk mitigation and management for the risk office? Well, hey, that's sustainability. Is it around setting, you know, strategy which drives value for the organization and its shareholders? Hate to tell you, that's also sustainability, you know, or is it actually around investor confidence in terms of any of the decisions making? Again, you have to lean in from sustainability. So it is a bit more practical than we've been used to, because a lot of what we've done has been setting the scene and providing the evidence.
Yeah.
We have that. Now it's about creating the action.
Yeah. You've touched on decision making there, and I am completely obsessed with the role of decision making when it comes to purpose-driven business, sustainability being absolutely central to core business rather than simply a sort of a side project. So I wanted to spend a bit of time talking about what it really looks like to embed sustainability into core business decisions. For the most part, board members are made up of people with really, you know, celebrated careers based on arguably economic models that we really need to challenge and reimagine. And therefore, how do we enable boards who should be able to take a long-term view to do that if all of their corporate and professional experience is based on sort of perhaps a different set of assumptions? I think it's a sort of really interesting challenge for us as people working in the space.
Yeah, and we talk about, of course, the corporate models, and particularly, of course, listed companies in the context of capital markets, as being something that's been around forever.
And it hasn't. It's not at all.
It's a relatively, you know, in our human history speaking, relatively recent phenomenon in terms of how we consider the, you know, the formation and the role of organizations in society. And I think that has changed. I think nobody takes, you know, an often misquoted, you know, Milton Friedman view that organizations need to be separated from society and not a part of it. But that said, I think you're right. I think a lot of people who sit on boards today have had celebrated careers in management where they were rewarded for short-termism. And there, you know, it wasn't like it was at the expense of the environment. Of course, now we know that that was in many cases, but people didn't know that at the time necessarily, and you hope. And so it is hard to get out of those mindsets. Hence why I say I think there's normally one or two people on a board who are, you know, the agitators. And that agitation is really needed. And if you have this healthy, it's not even really healthy conflict as much as healthy debate inside boards, those organizations are always the ones that thrive.
So I think we could probably accept that. So we've moved beyond like the win-win days of sustainability. I think a lot of the quick wins have been won, and we're really into the hard yards of getting things done. And one of my reflections is that as an industry, I don't think we've done enough to help organizations lean into tough choices and trade-offs. I don't know if you agree with that perspective or not, but if you do, I guess, do you have a sense of where leaders still underestimate the trade-offs when it comes to getting sustainability actually done within their organizations?
I really do agree that potentially we've been part of the problem in terms of helping organizations achieve these quick wins in order to get something on the map. With all the best intentions, we all wanted to say, if we can just get these things done, you'll see the benefits. But in doing that, of course, you quickly soaked up the activities that were sensible and prudent for everybody across the business to do without changing any of the dynamics around why you do these things. And so, yes, we are into the hard yards. I think that's a really fair reflection. The reality, though, is the hard yards is what's going to differentiate you from the pack, ultimately. Again, you can almost look at any single business school case study of an organization that has succeeded, you know, with a new initiative, a business plan, or even succeeded over the long term. And they've all been disruptive businesses who have done things in a way which has kind of done what we try and do in sustainability. Understand the significant challenges, get ahead of your competitors and outcompete.
Yeah.
We don't like to talk about that in sustainability. We don't like to talk about it as a competitive, you know, leading practice, but that's what it is, ultimately. Sadly, I think increasingly we are starting to, and we will start to see collapse scenarios though. There was an article in The Guardian back in 2025 from a board member of Allianz, so the largest insurance company in the world, called Gunther Thallinger. And Gunther made the comment that was, you know, we will likely see the insurance sector fail if we don't address climate change. The insurance sector collapses and brings with it financial markets. And this was almost a byline in a news article, in a paper, in a midweek that will have been just sort of skipped over by so many. And yet if we were to take that same sentiment and apply it to almost anything else, we would have 24/7 news cycles talking about this and needing to radically transform and do something, and regulators would be rallying. We've got a board member of one of the largest insurance companies in the world telling us that action on climate change in the short term could collapse capital markets. This is, I think, where we are. I mean, I think this is why it's so important, and this is why we need the storytelling. It's why we need the leadership. It's why we need a groundswell from within organizations. And to your earlier questions, it's why CSOs need to be very deliberate this year about what they're doing.
I agree. I remember reading the article in The Guardian and being surprised that this, I don't recall it being covered anywhere else. Why do you think that is?
Well, look, I no one really likes to forecast collapse. Let's be frank. And so I think there is a bit of a sense of techno-optimism, potentially, increasingly so as it relates to AI and its impacts and its capabilities. The other side is it's very hard to grapple with some of these very large concepts as an individual or even as a community, thinking through what beyond 3 degrees of warming means to us beyond the mid-century is really hard to rationalize. So I don't know. I mean, I think this is why we end up thinking, I think, this year around segmenting down, modularizing, you know, for want of a better word.
I love it. It's a great word. Invented it.
Try and break these things down a little bit, right? Like, yeah. Yes, we need to understand the long-term context. The long-term context is catastrophe, unavoided catastrophe. But if we're trying to avoid, what would be the modular approaches we need to take? Mm. And then how do we move faster on each of them? Mm. And I think then you get buy-in.
Mm. I think it's a really interesting provocation to sort of think about the idea that perhaps the blockbusters of this generation actually will be driven by insufficient response to climate change.
Yeah.
If you're a sustainability leader within an organization, you've set out your strategy. Like, what are the early warning signs to look for that the strategy is failing? Like, how can we help senior sustainability leaders sort of spot those warning signs before it gets too far?
I think for a number of sustainability leaders, they haven't spent enough time up front with stakeholders to understand where the barriers are actually going to be, and really testing some of those. There is a truism that I share with sustainability leaders, which is there is somebody else inside your organization who is likely paid more than you to take the counter view to yours. You need to know who those people are. You need to understand what their drivers are. And then you need to be able to find ways to be able to demonstrate that your initiatives, your drive, your change agenda actually benefits them.
Yeah.
And for sustainability professionals transforming a business, it's finding what that is for all of the stakeholders so that there's a common sense of value from this change, even if potentially they look at it in very different ways.
Yeah, no, it's so interesting. It reminds me of makes me think about a few things, actually. I think the first is that I hope we're moving away from the age of sustainability strategies that are designed to look good on a slide or in a sustainability report, and moving towards strategies that are designed to be successfully delivered within the organizational context that they were delivered for. And that does require, I think, a different approach to developing those strategies in the first place.
Sometimes we think that there's one path.
Yeah.
And sustainability leaders, you know, let's just add another, you know, tool to their tool belt, bless them. I mean, they're already these incredible polymath individuals who have to be so many things inside an organization. But let's add one more. They have to have multiple scenarios and the ability to quickly and flexibly move between them based on, you know, roadblocks, challenges, or changed opportunities that they see when they're working through. And I do think that is actually true. I think we have dogmatically attached ourselves to a single course of action that is the only course. And if we don't do it, it's all or nothing.
Yeah.
But again, just a caveat, it can't be nothing but tinged green, right? You know, this isn't an indictment of the sustainability profession. I think it's the lessons that we've learned from getting things wrong.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Now, obviously, we can't have a conversation about what's happening in the future without talking about AI and the role of technology. So let's spend a little bit of time on that. What I'm interested in hearing your perspective on is, where do you think technology is going to genuinely change the game for sustainability leaders in 26 versus where do you think it's just hype?
There has never been a single investment in a single technology that has as rapidly developed as AI. In our human history, it's almost impossible to try and put that into terms, because we look at benchmarks of LLMs and we look at, you know, the expansion of agentic methodologies to try and improve business systems or whatever it might be. But, you know, the AI tech we have today is like 100-fold better than it was a few weeks ago. It's expanding and changing so quickly. I don't know if I fall into a techno-optimist camp. I'm pretty sure I don't. But I am so powerfully driven to make sure that AI is there for good and not for expanding and, you know, continuing business practices that have got us to where we are.
Which way do you think it's going to go, Matt? And what are the factors that are going to influence that?
I think the biggest factor that will influence it is the leaning in of people who will shape its direction. So it's why I'm so vocal on the need for sustainability professionals to be part and parcel of the AI agenda. I've got a kind of counterintuitive view on AI as it relates to organizations, which is where a lot of our thinking is at the moment, right? How is AI going to either optimize a company or potentially remove the need for people in that company, etc.? I tend to think of this as three phases of AI, right? We tend to think at the moment inside of an organization that we need to be utilizing the latest technologies to improve the efficiency and, you know, the delivery capability of a company. And I think that's very much true. And that's kind of, I think, the base layer. The second layer then is, what are the things that we're doing manually today that will be replaced or significantly augmented by AI? And a huge amount of focus and media focus is there, because that has the ability to displace jobs, has the ability to, you know, massively improve the profitability of a certain company by changing what was a labor-driven dynamic to a GPU, a compute-powered dynamic. And again, a worthy area of focus. The third layer, though, is the bit that we tend not to focus on a great deal, other than when you hear, you know, incredible orators like Demis Hassabis from DeepMind talk, you know, the Nobel Prize winning in chemistry leader of DeepMind, which is really, what's the utility of AI, particularly as we head towards artificial general or artificial superintelligence, where the compute potentially has the ability to answer questions we've never been able to answer before. So in Demis' view, you know, when he won his Nobel Prize for AlphaFold, the ability for their AI technologies to be able to solve protein folding. Now, I did my PhD on protein folding. He just replaced me, ultimately, granted, you know, nearly 30 years ago. But But that for me is a great example of solving problems that we couldn't solve and we didn't think we would be able to solve in a very short period of time, because it took thousands of, if not hundreds of thousands of scientists and a huge amount of capital. And instead of doing those things in real life, we can do them in silico and then we can kind of test them in real life. Now, very little has been done to apply that to the challenges, the wicked problems that we face in sustainability. Imagine if we could apply AI to answering the question of where is all child labor today and how do we address it? Or, you know, how do we optimize our energy systems at a global level to stick within planetary limits? How do we optimize everything that we need to optimize to do what we think we need to do from a sustainability point of view? And that for me is where we should be spending our time.
And what are the conversations that need to happen? Where do we start to make that more of the focus for us as an industry, as a kind of profession?
Yeah, well, actually, you might have stumbled on it. I mean, it might be industry. It might actually be sector-wide. I think it's more at the company level where we've seen, you know, how do companies adopt to outcompete with their technologies? And potentially, we need to raise that up. How do we across sectors, or, you know, at national and government levels, raise this out to say, where should we focus our attention for AI and AI for good?
Okay, so to wrap things up, as we think about the year ahead, what do sustainability leaders worry about too much that maybe we could encourage them to strike off their worry list?
I think sustainability leaders worry too much about whether or not regulation or individual obligations go far enough. I think work with what you've got, do what you can, and collaborate as much as possible.
On the other hand, what are people not thinking enough about? You know, what's just around the corner that perhaps not everybody's seeing yet?
I actually think it's AI. I think the sustainability profession hasn't leaned into AI, and we're a little bit in denial that there is going to be such a huge change that's going to occur. And it might be this year, it might be the next 2 years or 5 or 10, we don't know, but let's get prepared.
And so what would success for sustainability leadership look like by the end of 26? Now, I love a sort of big lofty answer here, but let's try and be as realistic and practical as possible.
I think at an individual company level, if we look at the end of 26, I would love to see some actual outcomes from initiatives that are moving the organizations in the right direction and a commitment that those changes are going to be embedded elsewhere. Let's be practical. So we talked about the modularization of sustainability. What is it around a single product, a single business line, you know, a single geography within an organization that has made this transformation this year, and we're seeing some, that then could be applied to others because they see the business benefit of doing it. Wouldn't that be great?
Matt, thank you for being such a brilliant guest on Purposing.
It's been great to be here. Thanks, Becky.
Thanks again to Matt. Loads of brilliant ideas there. But there's one that I've really taken from the conversation. What does it mean to be an acceptable radical? Well, I think it's about being radical in our goals and in our ability to challenge the status quo, pushing businesses to go beyond short-termism and incrementalism, you know, pushing for true systemic change. And it's about being acceptable in our approach, speaking the language of business, building coalitions rather than alienating stakeholders, and framing change in ways that decision makers can hear. But I think the key thing is being able to walk a kind of tightrope. Too radical, you risk being ignored. Too acceptable, you're complicit in protecting the status quo. So in 2026, I'm embracing the role of an acceptable radical. Not acceptable because it's convenient, but because it's rooted in trust, grounded in reality, and impossible to ignore. My focus will be on stretching what's possible through meaningful relationships, challenging assumptions with both credibility and creativity, and turning uncomfortable truths into strategies that actually make change happen. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. If you'd like more practical advice on building a purpose-driven business with brilliant insights from people like Matt, Download the Insider's Guide to Purpose at givenagency.com/thinking.